Te Maria, welcome to First Up to a Tahiki Te Oho for Rā Mere. That is Friday, the 26th of April. Ko Nathan Rarere aho coming up. Bevan Hurley is following the various cases starring Donald Trump currently in front of US courts. Kalafi will be with us from Tonga. Also, Nabil has an eye on Africa for you. Two government ministers were stripped of their portfolios. Labour's deputy leader, Carmel Sepuluni, is with us for her reaction. And we meet a Phoenix football fan who supported the team through thick and a lot of thin.
I happened to be buying a car at the time. For the guy said, oh, the number plate's available. So I said, oh, yeah, I'll have a piece of that as well. So I bought the number plate. She had the number plate before we even had the team announced. I don't even think Ricky had been announced as the coach.
It'll be Friday. Welcome to First Up here to Tahiki Te Oho on RNZ National. We'll waste no time jumping into that big news overnight. As you heard, news out of the Big Apple that Harvey Weinstein has had a number of his convictions overturned. For the latest on that, Bevan Hurley is with us. Hey, thanks for being here, Bevan. What's happened now? Does this mean there's a retrial?
Morena, Nathan. Yes, it does. The Manhattan District Attorney's Office issued a statement a few minutes ago saying that they would seek a retrial. They said in a statement, we will do everything in our power to retry this case and remain steadfast in our commitment to survivors of sexual assault. So that 4-3 decision released by the New York State Appeals Court found that the trial judge had erred in allowing Weinstein to be cross-examined on prior sexual misconduct that he hadn't been prosecuted for. We've also heard from Douglas Woodore. He's an attorney who has represented 8 of Weinstein's accusers. Wigdor said that the decision was a major step back in holding those accountable for acts of sexual violence. He said that courts routinely admit evidence of other unchanged acts where they assist juries in understanding issues concerning the intent, modus operandi, or scheme of the defendant, and said that overturning the verdict was tragic and that it will require the victims to enjoy yet another trial. Donna Rotano, she was the lead defense attorney at Weinstein's trial, has taken a very different view point on it. She's released a statement saying that justice has been served. She said that the courts cannot operate on emotion and lack of due process, and that the decision restores faith in the foundation of our system. So this overturning relates to Weinstein's conviction in 2020 of first degree criminal sexual act and third degree rape. He was sentenced to 23 years in jail for that, and he remains incarcerated in upstate New York. There is no chance of it being released at this stage, as he was also sentenced to 16 years in prison in Los Angeles last year for rape and sexual assault.
Okay, let's move to more court action here. Donald Trump's name came up again at the Supreme Court today. This time it's about his claims of immunity from prosecution for alleged acts whilst president. What can you tell us about that?
Yeah, so Trump was sat in this drab Manhattan courtroom with a very keen eye on events in Washington, D.C., where the Supreme Court has been hearing these arguments on his claim to have complete immunity from prosecution. So the hearing relates to Trump's attempt to avoid prosecution for his efforts to overturn his 2020 election loss. It's provided this historic and surreal split screen. You know, we've got this former president, current presidential candidate, and four-time criminal defendant whose lawyers are fighting two very different sets of felony charges in two separate courthouses simultaneously. So this immunity claim had been emphatically rejected by lower courts. And the nine justices spent several hours quizzing lawyers for Trump and for the special counsel Jack Smith's office. They appeared to be sceptical of Trump's claim that he is entitled to sweeping or absolute immunity. They wrapped up just a short time ago, the oral arguments, and so we shall await keenly this written ruling. And once again, you know, this has had the desired effect of Trump for Trump of delaying this DC case from going to trial. Meanwhile, back in Manhattan, the former National Enquirer publisher David Pecker resumed giving evidence about the catch and kill scheme to bury negative stories about the president. And he was asked by the prosecutor if he had any legal concerns about buying a story to assist a political candidate. And he responded that he did, because he had previously done so for Arnold Schwarzenegger during his run for the California governorship in 2002. Pecker said that he purchased several stories from Whitman alleging that they'd had affairs with Schwarzenegger, so he knew that there was some legal peril in doing what he did.
Okay. Also, there have been indictments in Arizona regarding the 2020 election. Tell us who some of these people are, because they're quite well known.
Yeah, it's really been a head spinning 12 or 18 hours over here, Nathan. So last night, an Arizona grand jury indicted 18 allies of Donald Trump for their efforts to subvert the 2020 results in the state. And there's some familiar names. We've got former White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows, Trump attorneys Rudy Giuliani, Boris Epstein, John Eastman, Jenna Ellis, all of which I believe, apart from Epstein, were also charged in that Georgia case. And of course, Trump is an unindicted co-conspirator in this offending as well. So the names of those Trump affiliates were redacted, but it was easy to work out who they were from information in the indictment. There's also 11 Republicans who are quite prominent in state politics in Arizona who are named. And the reason that we're only seeing these charges brought now is because there was actually a Republican attorney general in power in Arizona until 2022, excuse me. And so the investigation only really got underway when Democrat Chris Mays was elected to the office in late 2022. But yeah, just extraordinary stuff at the moment, Nathan.
Yeah, absolutely. Look, thank you very much across all of it. That's Bevan Hurley with us from New York. And as you could hear there, there is a lot for him to be across. It's 12 past five here. You're listening to RNZ National. Nathan Rarere with you. First up, we go to the Pacific, reporting from the vast region. We head to Tonga, where our correspondent Kalafi Mawala stands by. Morena Kalafi, how you doing?
Good, thank you. Morena.
We've just had Anzac Day. Was Anzac Day marked in Tonga?
Yes, certainly. Anzac Day dawn services in Nuku'alofa yesterday remembered 94 young men from the islands who served in the First World War. The young men who enlisted were mainly expatriate Europeans who had been born in or worked in the kingdom, but several Tongans also enlisted. A roll call of the names of those who fought in the 1914-18 war contains familiar Tongan names: Fotu, Faletau, Tuinukuafe, Taliauli, Lomu, and Mohenoa. There are European names like Ledger, Mahoney, Cowley, Senth, Mueller, Payne, Harrow, Harper, Ramsey, Walter, and Lynch, which are still attached to large families on Tonga. Among those who went to war were people who rose to prominence later in life, such as Sateki Faletau, who served in the Maori contingent and the New Zealand Medical Corps and later became governor of Vavau and minister for police. Faletau's son Maile served during the Second World War as a medical officer. Only one Tongan died during the war. He was Sione Taliauli, who died of pneumonia in 1918. He's buried in Palestine. The names of the volunteers from Tonga are listed in a new book by Christian Liava'a, Koikau To'a Na'anau Poletau, or in English, Valiant Volunteers, Soldiers from Tonga in the Great War.
Let's get this news out of Samoa, where the sad news here, the dengue fever outbreak will officially be declared today. How many cases have been reported now?
Yes, there are more than 250 cases that have been reported, and the majority are on the mainland northwest of Upolu, where most of the population lives. The World Health Organization describes dengue fever as a viral infection that spreads from mosquitoes to people. Most people don't get symptoms, but for those who the most common were high fever, headache, body aches, nausea, and rash. Samoa's Director General of Health, Alec Ekeroma, says no one has died from it, but the country needs to continue its protection measures, and we're planning a national campaign to clean up and destroy breeding sites for mosquitoes.
Let's go to the Solomon Islands. The Prime Minister there has been re-elected in his local constituency. What else has come out of those elections?
Yes, it's the opening move in the political chess match to form the next government of the Solomon Islands. So far, at least four members of Sogavare's former cabinet have been re-elected, but it is still early days as the first upset of the election also took place overnight, with George Tema unseating Silas Tausinga in the West New Georgia Wonamona constituency. According to the Electoral Commission's political party breakdown of the election results received so far, Sogavare's Our Party is leading with 34% of votes counted, followed by the former opposition leader, Matthew Wallace, Solomon Islands Democratic Party, which has 26%. Independent election candidates round out the top three with 23.4% of the votes counted so far. And then there is a sharp drop off to the fourth place, People's First Party, on 8%. Coalition talks are already on the way.
Our correspondent in Tonga is Kalafi Mawaila. Kalafi, thank you very much for your time, sir. We get to hear from him every Friday, as we do, from our correspondent in Africa. He's in Ghana's capital of Accra. It's Nabil Ahmed Rufai. Morena, Nabil.
Morena, Nathan. I hope you're fine.
I am. Thank you very much, sir. Hey, there's been a mass prison break in Nigeria. How many inmates are now outmates?
Well, we understand more than 100 prisoners have actually escaped from the jail near Nigeria's capital after the heavy rainfall damaged part of the facility where they were housed. We are learning that that particular prison was built several decades ago, and the infrastructure was actually weak, which is why the heavy rainfall damaged it. And now authorities are saying that 118 inmates actually fled from the prison, but 10 have since been recaptured. And now they've launched a manhunt to find the others. Even though the identity of the prisoners is unclear, there are fears that some of them might be very dangerous. So the authorities have sent a caution to the people in Nigeria to be very wary and look out for any suspicious people and then report them to the authorities.
You mentioned there that heavy rain, which they managed to take advantage of. Rain's causing chaos in Kenya at the moment too, Nabil.
Yes, it's becoming very difficult with this whole climate change issue. And in Kenya, which is in East Africa, nearly 40 people have died as a result of devastating floods. Now, more than 40,000 people have been forced to flee their homes because of the rain and the flooding. And it's reported that some other residents were trapped in their homes after they climbed their rooftops, and they even spent a night over there. And there were rescue efforts that was done, and then they were taken out of that flat. Now, it's a really serious situation that's going on in Eastern Africa. And we've also heard that Tanzania, which is also close to Kenya, has also recorded floods, and it's becoming very, very devastating for a lot of people in that part of the world.
The United States are going to pull soldiers from Niger. What were they even doing there?
Well, there's been strained relations between Niger, a country in West Africa, and then the U.S. The U.S. had actually built a base in Niger over 6 years ago to help tackle the insurgency linked to militant groups like Al-Qaeda and its other offshoot groups. And because of the strained relations, Niger said they didn't want the camp to be there anymore. So the U.S. have now decided they would have to withdraw about 1,000 of the troops from the base in Niger. And well, even though Niger is happy about it, there are concerns about the impact that it would have on the wider West African sub-region, because that base has really for a long time helped thwart some attacks linked to these militant groups from spreading to the rest of West Africa. So there's a lot of people are not too happy about the withdrawal of the U.S. troops, but then it appears Niger is forming strong relationships with Russia, and it believes Russia will be able to help it in the fight against insurgency.
Yeah, thank you very much for your time. There you are, news from the African continent. Nabil Ahmed Rufai, who's in Ghana.
There they are, standing in the air. Big ones, small ones, some as big as your head.
There he you is. There he is, the Minister of Fruit and Veg. It's Glenn Forsyth. Morena, Glenn.
Morning, sir. How are you?
I'm very good. We head towards the last weekend of April. Sweet, sweet April 24. How are the veggies looking on this last weekend?
Yeah, rushing through. We finished the school holidays this weekend with an incredible array of fresh vegetables, and less is more, so let's summarise the hits. There are some good buys in tomatoes as more growers get started on their winter crops. Hardy crops look no further than pumpkin, kumara and potatoes, now with spud prices this season well back on last year's values, so that's going to be great all year for us. And brassicas in great supply, with broccoli in particular today being oversupplied. Now, you made an excellent suggestion on Monday too, Nate. Time is right to pre-make and freeze a week's supplies of soups for the whole family to eat for lunches, etc., and do it all again a week on. So, you know, big savings to be made as opposed to buying pouches of soups from the shops. But the vegetable we are showcasing today is a little pocket rocket brassica. Can you guess this one?
It's our friend, isn't it? It's the Brussels sprout, isn't it, Glenn? Is that what you're bringing to me, Glenn? Yes.
That's exactly right. Brussels sprouts. Love them or hate them, they are high in fibre, rich in antioxidants and cancer-protecting compounds. Now, the lovely Steph and Bruce from Snow Country Gardens, they have been growing them for 24 years under Mount Ruapehu on the beautiful volcanic plains. Now, we have more to share Monday, but what we have got to share online today is Stephanie's amazing Brussels infused potato and parsnip mash. And yes, it includes bacon and cheese, and you'll get addicted to Brussels after this one, I tell you.
I like it. I'm there already. Tell me about this. We've just covered off the, you were talking about vegetables getting hardier. What are we doing with fruit?
Yeah, a rebound in kiwi fruit and apple exports after Cyclone Gabrielle helped propel New Zealand into a trade surplus in March. Year on year, kiwi fruit up 125% already, and apples 27%. Our peekaboo pears are in China now, and our Fijo is in the USA. Our produce is everywhere, and our growers get a kick out of growing for New Zealand and the world. And the more we grow for export, we benefit at home. Look at the avocado season just gone. We had heaps left over to eat here. The same is going to happen this winter with kiwi fruit, apples and onions. Never a better year for years to get in behind our growers' product. Now, how good is your memory? Can you remember the name of those two Chinese gooseberry puppets that Zespri own?
I bet they've got names like Zess and Spree. That's normally how it works.
No, it's the Kiwi Brothers, remember?
Oh, was it? Watching Luke. Yeah.
So the Kiwi Brothers, they were at Shanghai Port welcoming the first charter vessel of New Zealand kiwi fruit. We are looking to increase some 40% this season into Greater China, and already they are saying it's the best early fruit they've seen in 4 years. Back home, green has started, but better buying this weekend is still on red and gold. Bananas are back in supply for school, and so are grapes that you could pop into containers for the little ones to avoid bruising them. And finally, we've been using fresh limes in our Manuka honey drinks as well. That's a great flavour too, you know, so you can mix it up a bit.
Getting a bit fancy. I reckon that the locals in China, they would have nicknamed those kiwi fruit ones. They would have called them like the hirsute Pac-Man or fuzzy Pac-Man or something like that, they'd call them as. Now, Glenn, one of the things that everyone looks forward to, because we make it appointment listening, what is your fruit of the week?
Okay, mate, New Zealand Satsuma mandarins.
Yes.
Oh, one of your favourites. They're here. Our mandarin season is underway, and without blowing our trumpet too much, we grow a magnificent satsuma down here in New Zealand. All of this great information this morning is from Johnny Reed, manager of Bell's Orchard, who has been growing these for 30 years. Now, Bell's is situated in one of the nicest areas of our country. To give you a clue, you can see some of the sand dunes at 90 Mile Beach from the orchard. Now, have you had a chance to buy any yet, Nathan?
I didn't get a chance to eat them. That's how quickly they disappeared, if you know what I mean. So yes, I did buy them.
Yeah, so they're in their prime right now. Not under mature, not over mature, with that perfect balance of sweet and tart. John says the next 2 weeks they will be at their absolute best. He loves them for the fact that they are easy peel, great for kids, punchy, healthy, and not a wasteful fruit, and that one or two in the lunchbox in their own wrapper gets finished. So that's what he means by not a wasteful fruit. Bell's produce, they pick and pack 5 days a week, so no need to store for too long. Fridge or fruit bowl, your preference, but Satsuma mandarins are the new kid on the block. Get into those.
Like sands through the hourglass, so are the days of our lives.
This is the day of our life we call April the 26th. Tomorrow, a former president will be sitting in court going, What is today? Why is today? It's something's happening today. It's Melania Trump's birthday tomorrow. Today, 54 years old. Also today, for anyone out there that's watched a movie and then gone out and gone, ha! And kicked the letterbox, Jet Li is 61 years old. Roger Taylor, the drummer from Duran Duran out of the Taylors, he is 64. And the wonderful Carol Burnett, who was in charge of one of my favourite sneaky TV shows that used to be on here in New Zealand late on a Friday night. It was called Fresno, bought the house down for me. I loved it. On this day in 1884, it was a first. It was the first time someone had actually ever taken a photograph of a tornado. It passed near Garnett, Kansas. There was a fellow by the name of A.A. Adams, lots of A's, who was 14 miles from it. He got out his camera. I don't know if it was a box brownie or whatever it was back in those days. Anyway, took the picture. Everyone went wow, and he capitalised on his work by selling souvenir cabinet cards and stereographs. On this day in 1994, South Africa began its first multiracial election. There were some releases on this day. In 89, Dragon Ball Z came out. 2017, The Handmaid's Tale hit screens. And in 2019, Avengers Endgame went out. It was quite successful. It made 4.7 billion New Zealand dollars. However, in 1995, Friday came out with Ice Cube. That was a heck of a movie. And on this day, 1941, this sound happened. Ray Nelson played the first organ at Wrigley Field. This was a baseball stadium there, and this where Wrigley chewing gum. Yeah, that's where it came from. Anyway, for the Chicago Cubs in 1941, and people went, well, this is just dandy, as they all walked in, and they liked that, but they had to stick him down behind the grandstands, and then they told him, you got to stop playing now, don't play during the game, because there was radio commentary, and they didn't have the rights to use the songs on the radio. So people loved it and they thought it was great, and they asked and asked and asked about it, but he only performed for one day, and then it was brought back only 26 years later. So there you go, it was a Lowry organ, and Jack Kearney went on to entertain fans from then on in 1967. Cash rules everything around me, cream get the money, dollar dollar bill, yo. From the business team, it's Anand Zaki. Kia ora Anand, how are you?
Kia ora, I'm well, thank you. How are you?
I'm pretty good. But New Zealanders who have been working hard are saying, I've got to keep working. Why are they delaying their retirement?
Yeah, that's right. We have this overseas study that used OECD data, and it looked at the average age of retirement among developed nations over the course of 20 years, so from 2000 to 2020. And it basically showed that the average age of retirement for New Zealanders was 67 in 2020, and this was up from 61 in 2000, so quite a jump in just 20 years. And the increase was actually the fourth highest of those surveyed. And New Zealand is the only non-European country in the top 10 in terms of increases in the age of retirement. And the top 10 was basically dominated by Baltic and other Eastern European countries. So we saw this data come through, and we spoke to the Retirement Commission about this to say, you know, what's going on here? And they say this really is no surprise, but they reckon that this actually reflects a positive change to retirement policies that took place in New Zealand 24 years ago. So in the year 2000, that basically freed up rules to give workers more flexibility about when they actually want to retire. And they said there's also no disincentive in New Zealand to continue to work beyond the age of 65. You can still get your super, for example. So they don't necessarily see this as a bad thing. And the commission say, you know, we've got a 25% workforce participation rate over the age of 65, which they say is also one of the highest in the OECD. So basically, they said there are a whole lot of things happening in the background that encourage workforce participation in that age group, and government policies also encourage workplaces to improve flexibility for older workers. So not necessarily a bad thing, according to the Retirement Commission, and they say many workers in New Zealand prefer to basically transition into retirement instead of just stopping work altogether. So not necessarily a bad thing.
All right. Thank you very much. It's Anand Zaki, and you can hear more from the business team on Morning Report this morning at 10 to 7. Let's go see what the New Zealand dollar is doing for you today. It buys you 59.34 US cents, 91.28 Australian cents, 47.53 British pence, 55.39 Euro cents, 92.29 Japanese yen, and 4.29 Chinese yuan. It is 27 to 6 right now. Well, the home grounds in Fiji have become a fortress for the Fijian Drua in Super Rugby Pacific. And this weekend, it's the turn of Moana Pacifica to try and storm those beaches. While the Hurricanes were too good for them last weekend, the Drua have managed home wins over the Crusaders, the Waratahs and the Western Force so far this year. Moana Pacifica also have 3 wins, including a victory over the Drua back in round 2. Moana assistant coach Tom Coventry says they know what they're in for in Lautoka on Saturday.
Their crowds are marvellous, aren't they? The only way you can really deal with the Fijian crowd is to make sure that you're playing good footy and playing on top of their team that they support. So obviously we're going to have to be very good. We play at Lautoka in the middle of the day, a little bit different than playing in Suva in the evening. As tough an event as you probably get in a rugby union game, in my opinion. We know we're up for a challenge. I think we've got some consistency with our team as far as selection goes, and hopefully we can gather that momentum that we had a week ago and continue on in Fiji. But we understand how tough it's going to be.
What happened with the Reds game, and how is that changing now with those sort of hefty losses you had before that? I mean, what's perhaps come together for you that you like the most?
I said right at the start of the year, we understood that we're going to struggle at times. And the reality is the best teams in the competition have a little bit on us at the moment. And our expectations have been around making sure we pick opportunities to stay in some of the games where we think we can compete a little bit harder. And that doesn't mean we go in with a mindset that we're going to give up points. We certainly weren't very happy about how that happened with the Blues and the Chiefs, for example. But in reality, we're trying to get through this season and ideally make the top 8. And that's what we're aiming for. That's been our mantra the whole year, is just getting better every week and picking off opportunities where we think we can challenge a team. There is a plan in place, even though at times you'd probably wonder whether it's going to plan, but we are trying to work to a formula around how we get through this season, considering our men, where we're at, some of the challenges we have with experience, et cetera, and making sure we get to the finish line in one piece.
So what do you take from the earlier game against them, considering now you're playing in Lautoka?
I think we had a reasonably good formula against them the first time. We managed to squeeze them at parts of the game that they weren't that comfortable with. I don't think the formula will change too much. Of just watching all the games of the teams we've played so far, there are some obvious trends around how the teams play the Fijians. So I'm sure we'll have those traits in our game as well.
Has there been any talk about bragging rights for the two Pacifica teams?
No, not as yet. I think that probably speaks for itself. And if you look at the points table, both teams are on 7th and 8th, respectively, and we're both on 13. I think they're ahead of us on points differential. There's plenty to play for, obviously, is when you're looking at the last 6 games of this competition, we need to be trying to pick up wins so we can, like I said, our goal was to make the top 8. So this is the big one for us, a big one for them. But there hasn't been a lot of talk, which is probably a good thing. I think we just need to let our footy do the talking. But I know there'll be a massive crowd there, and I know there'll be plenty of noise, and they've always got plenty of support, probably arguably the best support in the competition.
That's Moana Pacifica assistant coach Tom Coventry talking to Barry Guy. I'm Nathan Rarity talking to Barry Guy. How are you, Barry?
It's Friday, isn't it? I'm good.
I was thinking, if you're Barry Guy and you've been to ice hockey, now you're a hockey, you're like Barry Guy is your name now. You're a French-Canadian, like Montreal sort of guy.
Yeah, Patrick Roy.
Yeah, wah. There we go. I've always loved that one. Now, there is a game of T20 cricket going on. How are we doing?
Oh, it's pretty even at the moment, actually. Pakistan, we're in Lahore. This is game 4. It's 1-1 in the series. Pakistan won the toss, decided to field first. New Zealand scored 178 for 7. Tim Robinson, a young Wellington guy, I think he turns 22 this weekend. He top scored with 50-something, I think it was.
Yeah.
And I've just been asking around, and he's sort of, people tell me around, he's a bit of a thin Allen mould, actually, and he's got quite a future, apparently, according to the experts around Wellington. So he did pretty well. Foxcroft scored some runs as well, and in reply, Pakistan 133 for 4 after 16 overs. So I think we're in for a close one here, actually. It could go either way, but 178 for 7 after being asked to bat first in Lahore, I think so, is a pretty good score by this second string New Zealand side. So
yeah.
Exciting finish.
Now, in what was that movie called? Anchorman. Remember the Hello San Diego? Or my name's Ron Burgundy. It's almost like Up the Waz has a question mark after the up now, doesn't it? What's going on there?
Yes, I've just been listening to Andrew Webster, actually, and he said that really they're just not doing what the Warriors of recent times have been doing, they haven't been allowed to. He doesn't seem to be. He was really disappointed with last night's loss to Gold Coast, giving them their first win. But that, you know, he's excited that it's perhaps not too far away. That little individual incidents, he says, are killing them at the moment in the game. You know, whether it's a error, or you know, a turnover, or they, you know, or whatever, the other side scoring points off it, and they perhaps haven't defended the way that they want to. But he said it was a similar sort of record to last year, and they came through and did pretty well.
They
so
did come home,
he's excited. It is disappointing, obviously, but I don't know. I just get the feeling that him and also Tohu Harris that spoke that. Yeah, they can turn this around. That you know, and then they're 12th on the table. I think
we've got 30 seconds left, Barry. Tell me why the Wellington Phoenix are the greatest football team in the world right now. Easy, isn't it? Bandwagon. We're all going to the bandwagon, aren't we? This is it. This is us. National bandwagon time.
Yeah, yeah. It's one of those ones for me though that, you know, I don't want to chirp too much I have been known to do that before, so fingers crossed.
All right, we won't get to that. We'll just have a look at yesterday's result. Everton downing Liverpool. Goodness me. Right.
Yeah, they're done.
They're done. Thank you very much, Barry Guy. Cheers, Barry Guy there, who is in charge of the sport that happens in your ears right across the day. The Professionals, the Morning Report, are here after 6 o'clock. Ingrid Hipkiss with me right now in the studio. How you doing?
I certainly am. I'm very well, thanks. How are you?
Very good, thank you.
Great, excellent. Happy Friday to you. Now, we are looking at an interesting legal decision that's come out overnight with disgraced Hollywood mogul Harvey Weinstein having his 2020 rape conviction overturned. The media here has a new minister. Paul Goldsmith is now in charge after the sacking of Melissa Lee. We'll be hearing about his ideas for the sector. Anzac Day services, you'll remember, obviously marked in Gallipoli yesterday, but what you will remember is that our Defence Force bags and things all went missing with their uniforms and their instruments. So we'll talk to them about how they pulled that together. And we're also looking at, we've got our political panel too, a roundup of all political happenings for the week. Jumping spiders as well.
Oh, I love a jumping spider.
Yes, they're cunning.
Are they?
They've got tiny, tiny little brains, but they're very, very smart, Nathan. So we're going to find out all about that. Well, they do, yes. They are so smart, they would have had the forethought today off, so they had a nice long weekend.
Well, we didn't because we're
so
here
for silly
you.
Old us.
No, we're here for you, New Zealand,
okay,
aren't we?
Yes,
we're more
are.
Dedicated.
We are.
That's who we are. Thank you, Ingrid. Well, the Wellington Phoenix are poised to achieve something they've never done before in their 17-year history. A win against MacArthur FC in the capital this Saturday, which is their final game of the season, will see the Knicks sitting at the top of the table and in prime position to take out the Premiership. One man who has been through thick and a lot of thin is Foundation member Steve Still. He told me he loves the Phoenix and he loves them since the team was announced.
I've always been a football fan and played a bit of football as a youngster. Sadly, I had injuries, so any football career was curtailed fairly early. But as soon as the Phoenix were announced, I thought, gee, I'll buy into that. And I happened to be listening to Radio Sport one day, and they interviewed one of the early founders of Yellow Fever. And I thought, oh, I'll jump on board that. So I got home that day and joined Yellow Fever straight away. I was one of the first 30 or 40 people to have joined it and brought in. I happened to be buying a car at the time from Toyota, and the guy mentioned the Phoenix to the guy. When I went to pick the car up, the guy said, oh, the number plate's available.
Yeah.
So I said, oh, yeah, I'll have a piece of that as well. So I bought the so I actually had the number plate before we even had a team announced. I don't even think Ricky had been announced as the coach.
You sound like an all-in sort of guy. This wanting to be a part of this experience of it and realising, had you been to overseas football games before?
No, I hadn't. Having played football, I had an English coach, and he was a Spurs fan, and he was a fair bugger. He worked us fairly hard. So me and my mate decided he hated Manchester United. So we thought, oh, we'll support Manchester United. So we used to watch games with him. And I used to go to, back in the day, because I'm 70, I used to go to a lot of the Chatham Cup games at the Basin Reserve. And I've always sort of liked football, and I just sort of like the idea. I'm a Wellingtonian born and bred.
Hmm.
Love all things Wellington, and thought, you know, what better chance to be in at the start of a football club? And I thought, you know, yeah, I'll be part of that. So,
and the cool thing is the journey, right? So you can decide to pick up, and you know, like you see a lot of people. I know when they started watching football, if they're wearing a Manchester City shirt, I know. But you know, for you, there's high times, there's low times. I mean, look, we're heading towards a really big crowd. Tell us about some of those times where you've looked around where there were quite a few yellow seats.
Oh yeah, there's been a few highs and lows. You know, it's. I mean, I remember the very first practice game. Against Sydney City. I've still got the ticket at home somewhere, and it said we were playing at the Basin Reserve, but they sold too many tickets, so we ended up playing at Sky Stadium,
yeah,
or Westpac Stadium in those days. But we'd had a meeting with Yellow Fever, and there was no gear around, so the general consensus was, right, everybody wear something yellow and black. So the assortment of yellow and black jerseys was absolutely amazing. That very first game, there was rugby jerseys, there was league jerseys, there was T-shirts, there was all sorts of stuff, you know. And it was just, nobody knew one another. We all just, you know, introduced ourselves. And right from the beginning, there was sort of, you know, something there. And it was just the atmosphere that was created. You know, we'd go to the backbench of a pub before a game, and it used to be packed out, and there'd be chanting and all sorts of stuff. Mm. You know, there was just something there, and it was the atmosphere. I mean, I come from Wainui Amata, so it's a league and rugby town, and I've got friends who would go to a Phoenix game, and they'd sort of say, "What's this Phoenix?" And they'd go to a game, and I'd see them, and they'd sort of say, "They've never seen an atmosphere like it." They said, "For a small crowd, the noise that you guys generated is absolutely incredible." You know,
so. Yeah. And also, I mean, I've got sports teams that I love, but I don't have a giant tattoo of them on me. Tell us about you. I don't think you can go on an onsen in Japan. Tell us about your tattoo.
There's more to it than just being a Phoenix tattoo. I like tattoo work. I like, because I appreciate the artwork that's involved in them, and I've always wanted a back piece, and I sort of hadn't thought I should have come up with anything. One day I thought, oh, I might get a Phoenix one. And the Phoenix have been a fairly important part of my life. With, you know, the last few years, there's been a few health issues, and my daughter and I have both survived cancer, and it's sort of, you've got that 2 or 3 hours every week where you sort of just can forget about the shit, the rubbish that's going on in your life, you know.
Mm, which is so beautiful, yeah.
So as much as being about the Phoenix, it's also, you know, a celebration of my daughter and I both surviving cancer. So,
oh, well, that's fantastic. I'm very pleased you're here to get to watch this game, the MacArthur FC game Saturday, right? So Phoenix top of the table. This is great. Top of the table. It's so top of the table, the Shield's coming over for it. They'll be providing plenty of the noise, and the good part is, people of Wellington, you can go along and provide that noise too. The rest of us will look through the TV, and we will wish the best things for the Wellington Phoenix, and of course for Steve Still and everybody else there in the stand. Steve, thank you very much for your time, sir. Enjoy it.
Not a problem, I will. Yeah, and looking forward to a derby in Auckland also.
Steve Still there. Time now for our weekly catch-up with the Deputy Leader of the Opposition. It's Carmel Sepulone, who's up early with us. Kia ora, Carmel. Thanks for being here. How was your Anzac Day? What did you do?
Well, a bit different from every other year, because I think you might have heard I re-ruptured my Achilles,
yeah,
and so had surgery this time last week, so I haven't been out and about as much as I usually would. So, wasn't able to attend some of the Anzac commemorations that I usually would have, but certainly watched a lot on TV, watched a number of documentaries as well that I wouldn't usually otherwise have watched, and just kind of reflected along with many other New Zealanders on that day.
Yeah, and some rest, ice, compression, elevation. That's a good thing. Now, let's move to quite an interesting week, I guess, watching what's happening with the government. Penny Simmons has lost her disability issues portfolio. Tell me about what you saw of her time in that role.
What I saw was a minister who was completely out of their depth, that had no understanding for disabled people or for carers and their reality, who was incredibly judgmental and made very unfortunate comments about this particular community, didn't consult and made terrible decisions and has obviously been caught out. I thought it was really interesting, though, with both demotions of Melissa Lee and Penny Simmons, Christopher Luxon has tried to make out that the portfolios needed to be with more senior ministers and kind of refused to acknowledge that both the ministers had fallen short with respect to how they treated those portfolios and the work that they undertook. Basically, what we have here are serious performance issues. And I think it was clear to all of New Zealand that that was the case.
Yeah, well, I see. Well, Melissa Lee's been part of the National Caucus since 2008. So that's not an inexperienced minister.
No, that's right. I mean, to say that the portfolio needed to go to someone more senior when she's been around as an MP for 16 years, longer than me, we started at the same time, but I had 3 years out, is disingenuous. And yes, both ministers have fallen short. I think, the fact that within the first 6 months he's had to demote two of his ministers should be concerning in terms of the overall performance of his team. And so I guess we'll just have to see what happens in the coming months and who else loses their roles because they're not performing.
But on the other hand, though, isn't it good to see that you've got a Prime Minister here who's saying if these ministers aren't performing, they need to go?
Oh, they were seriously not performing. I think he was overstating his leadership with respect to his response. Interesting that he was saying something along the lines of, this is how I roll, this is how I lead. I don't know of any other former Prime Minister that spoke like that about themselves, to be honest. So he certainly likes to use leadership corporate jargon and to make out that he's this really strong leader in these situations, but it's just all talk. I think we need to watch this space with regards to other performance issues of his ministers.
The government's target of having 50,000 fewer people on a benefit by 2030, we see there that includes including people going to prison and also those who die, not just from people going into work. What do you think of that maths?
Well, I think that the minister herself has been quite dishonest about how they're going to achieve these numbers. She has been putting out there very strongly, along with the Prime Minister, that it will be because of their intense focus on getting people into work. And now we see that actually the numbers are not going to just be determined by work exits. It's exits overall, whether it's relationship status change, someone becomes eligible for superannuation, they move overseas, they're incarcerated, they pass away. And a large number of exits off benefit are actually not work exits. I think in the last quarter, only 48% were work exits and 52% were made up of everything else. So what I'm concerned about is actually, it won't be about focusing relentlessly on work. It will be focusing relentlessly on getting people off benefit with no regard for where they go to, or actually putting up barriers to people coming on benefit in the first place that will help them achieve their target of reducing beneficiaries by 50,000. That's not good for New Zealanders. You don't want people to have their access hampered because of a target and a government just wanting to make their books look good, particularly our most vulnerable New Zealanders.
The government has done a lot of stuff that I guess people would call bold. They're quite quick with things, whether people like it or not. They're very bold about gang patches, fast track consenting and other things. But I'm thinking here, where was Labor's boldness when you had that majority? Like, where was capital gain tax, for example?
Well, I mean, I think that we did a lot of things that were bold. You know, we reversed the benefit cuts of Ruth Richardson that had occurred in 1991. No other government had done that. We made a number of changes to the welfare system. We did things in ACC, like actually started to allow for birth injuries to be covered. You know, women have been underserved by the ACC scheme. You know, we made free public transport free for children and then half price for young people. Like, there were a lot of things that we did. I could just list them off, Nate. And I think that actually we're actually very bold. But, you know, perhaps we didn't pitch it in this jargon-filled corporate manner that this government is doing it. But I think they were very meaningful changes, and we could list them off on multiple pages, and I would consider those changes bold.
Yeah. Well, look, Carmel, I hope the Achilles continues to recover. Thank you very much for being up to speak to us here to finish our week of First Up. And that is the Deputy Leader of the Opposition, Carmel Sepuluni. A lot of messages in this morning. Ralph in Martinborough says, thanks, Nathan and the team, for not taking the long weekend. Those of us who also have to work this morning, salute you. Good on you, Ralph. I was feeling a bit dumb. I thought, oh, I should have done that. So, no, we're here for you. Good on you, Ralph. Someone here says, people are retiring later because they need to keep working financially. Retirement Commission needs to research better. Andrew in Bethel's Beach says, hey, at the end of the week, you play a little tune. I've never been able to understand it. Can you enlighten me? It's from a very old tune. Merv Griffith did a story version of it. It's called I've Got a Lovely Bunch of Coconuts, and it's basically about a fruit spruiker telling people to roll up with their bowl. A penny a pinch is what he says. Well, Morning Report is next with Ingrid and Corin. On this day in 2019, the Avengers Endgame came out. It went quite big. That's why we finished with this music. We remind you, you can download the podcast and take us with you. Otherwise, we're back in your ears on Monday.